Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I am excited to be bringing you a remote Skype connection from Mississippi tonight. We'll talk a little bit more about what's going on with that. Before we get into that, of course, we have to connect with Colorado. Sam, are you there?
I am here, and I'm kind of bummed because we didn't get much of an eclipse here. In fact, kind of nothing at all. Even though I was talking to Jim and he was telling me it was getting dark in Tennessee, but I guess I missed it. We're without Kyle tonight, unfortunately. He's on his way back here from SFO and doesn't have much of a data connection. So all he can say is we had an eclipse yesterday, in case any of you missed it. So that's kind of the weather news, if that's even weather at the moment.
And, of course, this will be coming out 3 weeks after the eclipse, so everybody will be really over the eclipse stuff.
That's kind of a moot point, yeah. But we have a really fun show tonight. We got both of our guys, Jim and Joe, here with us, and they have some friends coming to us from Mississippi. We're going to have an amazing topic tonight. I can't wait to dig into this. So, Jim, why don't you introduce your rogues gallery there?
So Paragon's kind of on a roadshow right now. We're just south of Memphis, which wasn't a stretch for us. And so we're at in a place called Tunica, Mississippi at Gold Strike Casino. We're doing an agricultural experience procedural cadaver lab tomorrow. So we've got a couple folks here with us. We've got Andre Merriweather, RN. We've got Amanda Bowen, Lieutenant with Memphis Fire Department. We have Lieutenant Kevin Spradlin and Chief Andrew Hart with us as well. So we've kind of commandeered for this lab a lot of folks from Memphis, and we're going to give them a good show tomorrow. But I think Sam and I had talked about Memphis Fire has embarked on a new community paramedic model, and we were going to talk about that tonight.
Exactly, and it sounds like a very unique model. So, Jim, why don't you just jump into that and tell us what makes that plan unique?
Well, I think it's better for these guys to talk about it. So I'll start out with Chief Hart, and we'll talk about how that all got started. So what brought this, there's a lot of models out there right now, but what made Memphis grab onto the model that they have right now?
So this is Andrew Hart. I'll start at the beginning. For the past 50-plus years, Memphis Fire has been running EMS the same way every year. You call 911, we pick you up and take you to the hospital. It doesn't matter what the complaint is, what the issue is, we're going to take you to the hospital. And the way the insurance model works, that's the only way we get paid, is if we take you to the hospital. So we're kind of perversely incentivized to take everybody to the ER, no matter what your need is.
So what was the change that made you guys shift to this new model that you guys are going to talk to us about tonight?
So a couple big things. First off, there was a core group of us that felt like for years, this is the wrong model, we need to fix it. But what hurt/helped is at the same time, finances started getting worse and worse for the city, but the need continued to increase. So looking year over year at Memphis Fire, we increased on average about 5% per year, our call volume. Last year, we ran over 130,000 EMS calls just for the city of Memphis. This year, we're actually on pace to get near 140,000. We're actually about a 7.5% increase rate right now. So what we found is people now call 911 for everything, not just the life-threatening emergency like it's designed, but anything and everything they need, any kind of social need at all. So we've looked at multiple programs geared around what can we do to, number one, pull all that off of our overtaxed ambulance service so that our ambulances are available for the true emergencies. But number two, what can we do to meet the need for people that either don't have anywhere else they can go or don't realize what other resources are out there available for them?
So how's this, you mentioned funding, and I think we're all kind of attuned to how we get paid for you know, transport services. How does this differ from traditional models?
So funding is an interesting question. That's our long-term goal is, in order for any program to be sustainable, we've got to have some sort of funding model to pay for the services and the staff. The unique thing about RADAR is we had a core group of people.
Let me stop you right there. What's RADAR stand for?
Rapid Assessment, Decision, and Redirection.
Wow.
So RADAR was the brainchild of Dr. Rick Donlin with a group called Resurrection Health. Resurrection Health is a group of doctors that are dedicated to serving the underserved in Memphis.
Interesting. So how do they tie into your program more than just as a name, or do they supply you? Looking for the word. Gosh,
they supply us resources and doctors. They
Thank
are
you.
An active participant in this program.
Yeah.
So what RADAR is, what it involves, is we have two cars. Instead of ambulances, we have cars
right.
that are staffed with a paramedic from Memphis Fire
mm-hmm.
and a doctor from Resurrection Health.
Wow.
So when calls go through 911, they get the EMD system, emergency medical dispatch, and determine, is this life-threatening? What kind of resources do we need to send? For calls that are determined to be alpha or non-emergent, which, by the way, for Memphis Fire, that's over 25,000 calls a year
wow.
are considered non-emergent. For those calls, instead of sending an ambulance and tying up the resource, we send the RADAR car.
So the dispatch protocol that you speak of, it that's the Jeff Clausen model?
Yes.
The EMD. And so what you're doing is kind of an alteration of that. And so how do you filter those calls to it coming down and being transferred from a regular 911 response to the RADAR response?
So that's a twofold answer to that. Right now, what we're doing is once the dispatchers code it as an alpha call, they determine that it's non-emergent through
right.
their triage process, then instead of sending an ambulance, they send the RADAR car if it's in service and nearby available. At the same time, we're actually adding nurses to our dispatch. We're about
wow.
to go live with that program.
Nice.
So that starting next month, those alpha calls will actually go to the nurse first, who will triage a little bit more in depth and determine, is RADAR the right service, or can we just refer them directly to a doctor or whatever else they may need.
Right. So Jamie or Sam, do you have any questions?
Well, you know, because I'm not as familiar with the Memphis Fire model, is your ambulance service directly associated with fire, or is it a private service? I mean, on a regular day outside this program.
Yes. So Memphis Fire is dual role. That means we have firefighter paramedics that half the time they're at work, they're on a fire truck. The other half the time they're on an ambulance. They rotate back and forth. We have had an ambulance service with Memphis Fire since 1966, so we're in our 51st year now.
So would you guys consider this a sort of community paramedicine type program, or is it its own unique thing?
So Kevin, so I think Lieutenant Spratlin can answer that question a little better. So he's kind of tied as far as the state piece of it and locally. So Kevin.
So I think to answer your question, not directly. I don't believe it's actually community paramedicine. However, it is a form of mobile integrated healthcare in that we're taking a multidisciplinary approach to finding the right resource for the people that we serve. Community paramedicine, by definition, would be using a community paramedic to do that work. And in Tennessee, we're not quite to that point. For about 3 years now, we've had a task force that has been working to develop such a credential and develop a rule and had it passed by our regulatory board about a year and a half ago. But it's been tied up with the attorneys ever since. So hopefully we're to the point of having community paramedics in our state very soon. So RADAR itself is not truly community paramedicine. It's more of a mobile integrated healthcare program.
So to clarify, can one of you give us an example of a typical alpha call and what the steps would be when the RADAR responds?
Sure.
Sure.
So Alpha Call, first off, there's not a typical one. It runs the gamut. It's it just about anything non-emergent. So it could be a 20-year-old with a sore throat. It could be toothache. That's a fairly common one. It could be, on the other extreme, an 80-year-old that says, I just don't feel good in general. And when you get there, you realize they have multiple comorbidities, all kinds of medical issues going on, and it turns out to actually be more of an emergent call. So it's really wide open as far as what kind of calls we go on.
So
one thing I want to stress with radar, so what we looked at, the current model is for these alpha calls before radar, it didn't matter what the call was, we take you to the hospital. So if it's, for example, a 20-year-old with a sore throat, we would give them a $1,000 ambulance ride to a hospital where there's a $1,000 ER visit, and then another bill for the doctor who will come in and do what's called an MSE, a medical screening exam. They'll determine that there is nothing emergent going on with the patient, rule out all the critical stuff, and say, well, there's nothing critical going on. You need to go follow up with your doctor. There's nothing we can do for you. So we have tied up tons of resources, spent thousands of dollars just to tell somebody you need to go see your doctor.
Yeah, you think that would be blatantly obvious.
Yes. So what we've done with radar is essentially taken that MSE to the patient's house. Instead of giving that $1,000 ride to the $1,000 ER to the doctor visit to get the medical screen, we bring the doctor out to them and do a medical screen on site. One thing I do want to be very clear on is we are not doing doctor house calls. So we are not bringing a primary care doctor to somebody's house where they're going to take care of all the issues. All they are doing is determining, is this life-threatening, non-life-threatening? If it is non-life-threatening, truly non-life-threatening, then what resource do you need? If it's, I need to see my primary care doctor, then our paramedic and doctor on site work on, let's get you set up with your primary care doctor. And they get either a same day or next day appointment to follow up with that doctor. The other thing we work on is transportation. Do you have a ride? Let's get you a ride there.
Yeah, that's often the problem with some people. So you're saving them a boatload of money while you're saving the fire department a lot of resources, correct?
Yes, and also saving the hospital a lot of resources.
Yes, when they get slammed with a bunch of people that don't really need to be in the ER, that makes a lot of sense. So did I hear that some of the docs working the system are USAR docs?
So
there's one.
Joe. I guess yeah, that would be me. You know, the physicians that are working with us in this program are primarily primary care family practice guys that run these clinics for the underserved population in Memphis, and this is a bit of an outreach program for them. Although I think it fits in well with sort of that whole USAR approach to things. I mean, this is kind of disaster medicine in a way, in that the need for resources is well beyond the ability to deliver those resources. And, you know, part of what this program is designed to do is to not really triage in an official sense, but to appropriately utilize the small number of resources that we have for the overwhelming demand for those services, and try to connect people with the services that they ultimately need in the most efficient way that we're able to do that. So, you know, I think it's taking a bit of a disaster medicine approach to kind of primary care and non-emergent situations in day-to-day practice that are overwhelming our ability to take care of them otherwise.
That makes sense, Joe. Jamie, do you have any questions?
Well, I've been following community paramedicine for a long time as the process has been evolving for the last, well, heck, I've been doing this for 8 to 10 years now, watching the changes and the different models that have popped up. And this one seems a lot more like some of the European models that have been in place for years. Is that something that you all looked at before this system was put in place?
Not really, no, actually. So two things about that. First off, I'll talk about the sustainable portion. We realized right away that this is not something that we can fund indefinitely. So Dr. Rick Donlin and the docs at Resurrection Health are dedicated enough to this mission that they have actually, for this pilot program, this six-month pilot, they have been donating their time, along with us donating quite a bit of our time and resources. And then we've reached out to one of our local philanthropic Plow Foundation, actually provided the vehicles and some of the equipment for us.
Great.
So it's awesome. It's really been a group effort, all working together with the knowledge and the goal of we've got to work towards a sustainable model. So what we're working towards and what we're very close to going to is a more of a telemedicine piece, where the cars will be staffed with a paramedic and an EMT from Memphis Fire. They'll go on these same calls and pull up one of the doctors by telemedicine on video conference and do the medical screen that way. It's two things, much more affordable, number one, but also much more effective. Instead of having that doctor spending a lot of time driving around call to call, they can be at one location and receiving multiple calls an hour instead of just one.
That makes a lot of sense. So were you going to have nurses in this model as well, did you say earlier?
So we're adding nurses to our dispatch center so that for these calls that are determined alpha, we can get a bit more in-depth with the triage and really hone down on what is the true need for this patient. One of the things we've realized, for example, I mentioned the 80-year-old that says, I just feel bad in general and doesn't give any real specific complaints. The nurses will be a great help in really keying down on what all medical conditions do you really have that you're not mentioning to us that's going on with you. And then on the flip side, our 20-year-olds love to talk about, I'm horrible, dying, end of the world, bad stuff. And when you really talk to them, it's, I've got a sore throat. There's not that much going on. I just don't feel good. So they can really key in on what are the calls that truly need a radar doc to be on scene.
So are you guys just addressing alphas or any bravos? Or just
excellent question. So when we first started this, it was just alpha. But we've known all along that a lot of our Bravo, Charlie, and Delta calls, sometimes they're overstated. They, for example, said they're sweaty, short of breath, changing color, chest pain, all this, and really it's just a toe pain. Or sometimes it's something that truly is life-threatening initially, like the diabetic coma. Yeah, they do have a life-threatening emergency, but we can go on scene and fix that fairly rapidly. And they really don't need to go to a hospital for that. So we have already realized, and we've already started moving towards with the radar model of let's go on some of these Bravo calls, some of these Charlie calls, the ones that we think can be handled on scene and then at a primary care doctor.
Well, let me clarify.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to... Yeah, you said something about having a nurse in dispatch. Would that be for the purpose of the nurse being able to make a good decision on what the radar should run on, even if it, regardless of whether it's Alpha, Bravo, or Charlie?
Yes, that is part of it. And then also the nurse for calls when, say, for example, radar is tied up on other calls, there are a portion of calls that the nurse can talk through the patient and say, actually, what you really need is to stay home, rest, hydrate, and if you don't feel better in 24 hours, then get an appointment with your doctor. So there's a lot of calls that we really don't need to send any resources at all out there.
Well, that makes sense. So do you think this is a model that will catch on elsewhere with other fire departments, some of which are not even running alphas anymore, especially with the public-private model?
I most definitely do.
And the reason is, so one of the big things we've done during this pilot is collect a lot of data to be able to prove, does this work, does this not work, how efficient is it really? And with that data, we've been able to meet with insurers, and we are actually in the final phases of signing contracts with some insurers to pay for this service. So wow. I think the insurer is right away. It's a whole lot cheaper to pay this one group a small amount to treat them on scene and be done than to give them a ride to a hospital, be seen at the hospital, and then just send them to a doctor.
And that's a thing, too, that you don't realize how many moving parts there are to this plan. Things like that I wouldn't have thought of, you know, immediately. But, yeah, you got to get the insurance companies to buy into this, too. But it makes a lot of sense for them as well.
It does. And we've had great success with radar so far without going too deep. And I'll tell you that about 58% of the patients that we encounter are either handled by primary care or just treated at the location with no further treatment necessary. And 66% of the people that we encounter do not end up being transported by one of our ambulances. So what that means is there's a small percentage of patients that we see on scene that end up in the ER that don't go by one of our ambulances. But just starting out the gate, we were very consistent around 54-55% in redirecting people away from the emergency department and into some other form of care. And we hope with the nurses in place, we'll be even more successful with that.
Yeah, you guys will be able to mine some awesome data from this program.
Yes, it's hard to get otherwise. And we've hired an outside group to come in and help us look at that data also to give us an objective analysis of what we're doing and help us formulate a persuasive argument on why we should be reimbursed for this type of work. Most of the people that we encounter, I'd like to mention one thing there, are insured of some sort. Many of them are on TennCare, which is Tennessee Medicaid. But many people that we talk to about this type of program assume that we're dealing with a whole lot of uninsured people, but that's a small percentage of the payer mix that we serve. It's been quite interesting to find that most of the people that are calling us for these non-emergencies actually have insurance coverage and have some sort of physician that they're assigned to see, but do not have a relationship with that doctor. So one of our goals in this project is to connect them with that primary care doc and have that relationship that they need to care for whatever medical problems they've got.
So I'm just kind of wondering, how surprised are they when a radar car shows up instead of a fire engine and an ambulance? Is that a surprise?
So I've asked that question of a lot of the folks that have been around the program, and overwhelmingly it's a positive response. We get a lot of folks who tell us they're just relieved that somebody can tell them that it's okay. We also get reports of family members who will say, well, I told the patient that they didn't need to call, but they did anyway, and so they're relieved when we show up. It's been a very rare occurrence when someone was not happy about what's going on with the radar car arriving on scene. We've been very pleased. I've only dealt with a couple of complaints that I recall, and both of them were easily managed. So it's been a good reception.
And I'll piggyback on that. So we have a separate program that looks at our high utilizers. And for Memphis Fire, a high utilizer is anybody that calls four or more times in a week. The reason we set the number that high is because that has a pool of about 350 people that we're dealing with. If we set it much lower, it'd be more than we could manage. But with that group of high utilizers, when we first started dealing with them, we used the word 911 abuse quite a bit. And we realized right away that for the vast majority of patients, that was not true. So for the top five or six patients, they are the true 911 abusers. They are the people that are playing the system, know that what they're doing is wrong, and don't care. But for the other 98-99%, the vast majority, that they're not playing the system. They're doing what they were taught by their parents, or they don't have a ride and this is the only way they know to get care, or they don't have a primary care doc, or their doc said, I can't get you in for 3 months, or a variety of other reasons. They don't realize what resources are out there for them. They just know that if I call 911, then somebody will come take care of me and I will get help.
So do you think, I'm just speculating here, that true abusers, are they going to be, are they going to change their behavior with a radar car responding? I'm trying to figure out what it is that they're attracted to that they keep calling.
So that is actually one of the complaints that Kevin just mentioned earlier, is the Res Health docs actually kind of adopted one of our true abusers. And he complained about it some. And the other thing he's done is he's realized that for this pilot program, our radar car is only running Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. And he started waiting until 5 p.m. to call because he knew radar would be out of service then.
Wow. That's always the way.
We're about to go 24/7, so he'll be out of luck then.
Well, here's my favorite question, and Jim knows what it is. Say your program's successful, and you have a whole bunch of folks out there in radar cars that aren't normally part of the fire department, and there's, and sorry to say this, Joe, don't get nervous, but there's a big event in your area that requires a lot more resources than you generally have, which is always the case. How could you incorporate some of these folks that are great practitioners into a disaster plan?
So this is Jim. So for the listener out there, everyone in the room right now is has a disaster background, especially Kevin and Andrew both, who manage this program. So I guess the toss would be if we had a Katrina or, you know, some type of man-made or natural disaster that hit our area, how would the radar program, what would you see its benefits? And a lot of it, you know, we're really good at the response phase these days. I mean, we can always be better, but we're really good at it. But as we know, that during the recovery phase, there's a lot of working pieces that go on as far as tertiary care and things like that. So how would you guys see this working?
So I would begin by saying that in the initial phases, what we could use our personnel for would be several things. We could, if needed, to fill in as providers, but more importantly, I'd like to see them as part of the ICS system where they're filling different roles within the system. We may have them assigned to staff, triage, treatment, or transport, or something along those lines. So our goal is to train these folks to be prepared to fill in those spots. We do have EMS supervisors out on the street who can do some of that, but in a big incident, it wouldn't be adequate. So my goal is to have our folks a little better at the ICS system and able to fill into those roles so they can direct other resources that are beneath them.
Well, you're lucky.
And I'll add to that.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'll add to that, that we have several great options with them. First off is the quick and easy. If we need lots more ambulances, we have some reserve ambulances that we can pull this staff and put them on the ambulance and get more ambulances on the street. But the other thing to me, which is the probably better option, is a large percentage of those calls, just like our day-to-day calls, is going to be more of, I have what to me is an emergency, but wait, what may not actually be life-threatening. And this, again, frees up our ambulances so we can have resources going out and dealing with urgent situations, but not emergent situations.
Plus a behavioral health component there.
Behavioral health is a big component of that.
Oh, yeah, and then, I can imagine.
And then the biggest thing of all to me is really what we're doing with this community-wide involvement. And we actually have a steering committee made up of the mayor and the fire director, the CEOs of all the major hospitals, the big primary care places like Resurrection Health, Christ Community Clinic, Public Health Department, our mobile crisis folks, all of these people meeting together quarterly to talk about how do we deal with this overwhelming influx of non-emergent calls. But the beauty of that is we've developed all these relationships that we can use in a disaster. It's not who can I reach out to. It's I know exactly who I can reach out, exactly who I can call, what they can do, what kind of resources they can offer, and we can all assist each other much more effectively than if we were just operating in silos and didn't really know what all resources were out there.
That makes perfect sense. Jim, what kind of training, I mean, your people are obviously trained in what they do, but how much training is involved in getting them set up for the system?
So that's a question for Lieutenant Spratlin.
So what we've done there is we began by taking volunteers. We put out a memo that said, we're starting a new program. Here are the objectives. If you're interested, come talk to us. And we had a group of those folks who went through a two-week training period, and we talked to them about all sorts of issues related to finding psychosocial resources for people in the community, dealing with chronic diseases, looking at the societal impacts on healthcare, and lots of other things. We brought in subject matter experts from across the community and talked about those things. And from that group, we selected the first couple of folks who were going to be involved in the program and have chosen a few more since then. And as we've gone along, we've just kind of been tackling topics as we encounter them and building that into our best practices, if you will. The second piece of this will be when Tennessee gets a community paramedic credential in place, there will be a formal education component that goes with it, and that will involve approximately 170 hours of classroom and clinical and laboratory time to prepare them for testing and hoping to get that community paramedic endorsement. So we hope to see that in the next few months.
Well, I don't know. I'm sure Jamie agrees with me. I am completely impressed. And since I've known Jim, which has been quite a while, he brags about how Memphis has always been on the cutting edge. And this is another clear example of that. Would you agree, Jamie?
Absolutely. And I think it's an example of, you know, a community coming together with multiple resources and pointing everybody in the same direction with the similar focus to solve a problem. And I wish I'd see more communities around the country tackling things in this way, but it's refreshing to see communities like Memphis doing that. You know, I'm thinking, Joe and Jim, that this is a unique type of resource and training opportunity for, you know, communities to bring responders on and train them. But it's much like what the type of training you guys do with Paragon, you know, just kind of doing something refreshing, something different.
Well, I think you're right, Jamie, and thanks for that. You know, it's a pretty cutting edge kind of program. I think it has in many ways grown out of our disaster response background, in that we spend a lot of time in both of these worlds matching up needs to available resources. It's just a bit different take on that. So, you know, it certainly bleeds over in both directions and is an integral part of the training, and it's part of the reason that these incredible people are part of our company and provide this kind of training.
You know, you guys are doing this training down in Mississippi. I know it's an agricultural focus, and I think we talk a lot about the type of disaster training you do, but you guys are just available to put any kind of training program together for a community that needs something in a specific fashion. Where can they reach out to you and find out exactly what you can do and bring into their system to help them get better at what they do?
Well, you can certainly find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. We have a Facebook page by the same name. You can reach us through the Disaster Podcast or on the Disaster Podcast Facebook page. And we would absolutely encourage folks to just reach out to us. I think in many cases, your imagination is what drives our training. And you just tell us what you're interested in, and we'll be glad to put something together for you.
Awesome. And I can't recommend it highly enough. And again, it's great to be associated with you here on the podcast and have your support to continue to bring this podcast to people. And I'd urge our audience to consider reaching out to Paragon, checking out their website, checking out their resources, and finding out what they can do for you. Because I think in a large part, you'll be amazed and impressed with the types of things you end up with when partnering with them. And so thanks, Joe and Jim and the rest of the team there. And I'm sure Mississippi's going to get a really amazing program tomorrow down there in Tunica. Sam, where can folks find you online?
Well, like Joe said, the disasterpodcast.com website, the Facebook page, other social media under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. How about you, Podmedic?
Well, as Sam said, under the handle Podmedic is where you'll find me under most social media sites. So please look me up, friend or follow me there. And I look forward to hearing from you and connecting with folks. And, of course, always over at the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. Just search Disaster Podcast and ask to join the group. And we'll be glad to let you in. And you can have a conversation on any episode there. Just leave a comment on any of the episode posts. And often we have our guests as members of the group as well, and they can respond directly back to your questions. So look us up there. You know, Sam, I'm thinking about this episode. It's this is a perfect example of the different ways that medical care are being innovated in and around our country, and it's an exciting time to be part of this type of system.
And it's necessary. I mean, even though we couldn't consider this disaster medicine so much, it's a preemptive strike. Departments have to get creative to figure out better ways and more financially feasible ways of doing things. And it sounds like Memphis is doing just that. So it's a preemptive strike to show that disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine. And hopefully it won't be for Memphis.